Let's talk.
John Brown. Searching for my slave roots from Guyana's sugar plantations to Cambridge, a new history of the legacies of slavery and colonialism. It's been written by Malik Al-Nassar. I'm delighted to say that Malik joins me live on the line. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Giles. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts are you this morning, by the way?
I'm actually in Liverpool.
Fantastic. Good place to be. Absolutely. For those who don't know you, just explain a little bit about why you are so eminently qualified to write this book and a little bit about your background. Because you work with one of my heroes, it was Gil Scott-Heron.
Yeah, so I was born in Liverpool in 1966 and grew up in the 70s. And unfortunately, I was 8 years old. My father had a stroke and became a quadriplegic. And I was taken into care the following year when I was 9. So I spent my childhood years basically in the care system. And during that time, I had been made to work on a farm doing sort of child slave labor. I was, you know, out of school, didn't have any qualifications. By 18, I was kind of dumped in a homeless hostel in Toxteth, in post-riot Toxteth in Liverpool. And I was semi-literate. So it was just fortunate that year I happened to meet the legendary poet and activist Gil Scott-Heron, and he was on tour at the time with his band. He took a shine to me, took me on the road with his band, and he was a very educated man. He had a master's degree from Johns Hopkins in America. He also had a band. He had a record in the charts. It was, you know, he was doing big things, and he encouraged me through poetry to become literate and to try and understand my history, because I'd grown up on a kind of predominantly white council estate. There was only 4 black families, 100,000 white families. Yeah. You know, the N-word was like almost my name. So, you know, I'd never been made to feel welcome. I'd always been told, oh, go back to where you came from and so on. So I didn't know where that was. And my father had died when I was 15. When I came out the care system, I was, you know, sort of semi-orphan, semi-literate. And with Gil's mentoring, I started to look at my history, my origins, but I also became literate. I went on to graduate from all 3 of Liverpool's universities, and I'm currently doing a PhD at the University of Cambridge, which I've just recently submitted my thesis. And part of that was researching my family roots through my father's line, tracing it back to what was then British Guyana. My father was born there in 1918. He came as a colonial seaman to Britain in the 1930s. He fought the Nazis in World War II, and then settled in Liverpool after the war, at a time when there was like signs in the window, no dogs, no Irish, no blacks. So having fought for the country and being, you know, a veteran, he wasn't even welcomed into the British Legion, even though he was entitled to be there. And he never, ever attended. You know, his wife, who was white, attended, but he never attended. So I kept feeling like, why have we got this sort of thing where, you know, we've contributed so much to the British Empire? You know, what's this history that makes us be so unwelcome, you know, as the children of people who fought for the empire? And that was the beginning of my journey, if you like, to really try and understand my roots.
It's really interesting you say being taken on, because Gil Scott-Heron, as you said, poet, writer, highly literate, and he's using his music to get his message across. And for yourself, because I'm born in 68, so I'm, you know, we've grown up at the same time, and we remember. I mean, I'm, you know, hey, listen, I'm a middle class white boy from Stoke-on-Trent, but if you look at the, I mean, it's not great now, but it's better than it was. And if you remember the, you know, the British National Party, the National Front, the TV, you know, the way that you're from Toxteth, and we know, you know, the riots were seen as a black issue. You know, really, I mean, you could have gone either way, couldn't you, Malik, if you think about it? We could have not been having this conversation.
Well, you see, this is the thing as well. You've got to understand, really, the origins of racism. If you understand the origins of racism, you'll understand how the society became so polarized. And it was only when I really started to go back through my family tree on my father's side that I started to see where racism began. And racism began in, you know, the kind of post-Columbus colonial adventure to take over the world, to establish Christianity as the supreme religion, and to establish white supremacy. And don't forget, prior to Columbus in 1492 and his famous voyage to America, most of Southern Europe was ruled by black African Muslims. You know, it was the Moors from Tariq ibn Ziyad in the 7th century through until the Reconquista and Ferdinand and Isabella. And, you know, the Moors brought science, they brought technology, they brought philosophy, they brought papermaking from China. You know, they built so much of Spain. You know, when you see all these areas of Aragon and Castile and these places, you know, the fantastic buildings that they're Moorish. You know, if you go down into Fuengirola and Granada.
I'm sitting in a studio in Al-Andalus. I'm sitting close to Estepona.
It was called the Iberian Emirates, you know, and Al-Andalusia is an Arabic word, you know. Portugal means orange in Arabic, you know. It's they took oranges from North Africa and brought them in and planted them there and called it the land of oranges, and that's how Portugal got its name. So, you know, they brought civilization from Africa to Europe at a time when Europe was quite barbaric. And then, you know, Ferdinand and Isabella had this thing that was like, well, we'll just chase them out of Europe back into Africa, and then we'll chase them into Africa and make sure they never again threaten Europe. And they created all these narratives of them being barbarians and heathens and the Barbary Coast. And you go to Gibraltar, they got the Barbary Ape, and, you know, and then they started to try and make those narratives real. I mean, when they arrived in Mali, the library in Timbuktu in Mali had over 1 million volumes handwritten in multiple languages. So the idea that Africans didn't have a writing system and they didn't read and all of this, you know, that most of the West Africans were incredibly literate in more than one language. And this narrative was like, they, you know, they captured them, they put them on the ships, they shipped them off to America, they made it illegal to teach them to read or write, they made it illegal for them to be seen reading or writing, they changed their names, they changed their religions, and they forced them into this kind of docile state, which they then left them in. And these narratives that they created, these pseudo-scientific narratives of black people are closer in the evolutionary chain to monkeys than men, and they're not from Homo sapiens, and they went on the boat with Noah, and all this kind of stuff. This all happened during that colonial period from 1492 up to the 19th century. And many of those slave traders paid for the development of churches, but they also paid for the development of institutions of learning and knowledge production. And these guys who I'm studying, a firm called Sam Bachtini, based in Liverpool and Glasgow, were right at the heart of that. They were right at the epicenter of it.
Because they're using the Christianity to say these people aren't Christians, therefore they are savages. They're not Christians, therefore they don't have a civilization. Both in South America and Central America, because of the Maya, the Inca, the Aztec. And you just hit one of my favorites. We could bore each other silly about the Al-Andalus, but also that whole Mali thing. You know, the Moors go and they take gold from Mali. It comes Timbuktu, massive library that gets smuggled out. There's a wonderful book called The Book Smugglers of Timbuktu. So they're using the Christianity, their Christianity, as a sort of dual thing to oppress and say, right, that's, we can enslave these people. We could do horrible things to these people because they're not quote unquote civilized. How do you start though on this journey of, so you're on your father's side? How do you get the genealogy going, Mike? That's what I'm trying to say.
So basically, it all started with the genealogy.
He's holding a family tree.
A family tree here. My actual family tree that's got about at least 1,400 people in it. Now, on some of these characters that I came to on my father's side, there is incredibly powerful white Europeans in the family tree because they were the ones who had the money to go and build a ship and take it out there and do the whole slavery thing. And they made fortunes from that. So it was those rich families and those royal endowments through Royal Africa companies and royal charters and letters of marque that enabled them to really go out and kind of proliferate within the Caribbean and the Americas. So I think what really got me started on the family tree was actually the discovery of a black footballer from the 19th century called Andrew Watson. Now, you can Google this guy. He's incredible. He was born in 1856 in Demerara in what was British Guyana to a white Scottish sugar merchant called Peter Miller Watson and a black woman who'd been born enslaved but had been manumitted by her owner, who was also her father, okay, when she was an infant. So this other Scottish guy, Andrew Rose, had a black child with the slave girl, Minky, We don't know his surname because they didn't give them surnames. They only gave them first names, generally. And Minky's child was manumitted along with Minky when she was born.
Manumitted, manumitted
just means set free. So right. Any white person could own a slave.
Yeah.
Any white person could free a slave.
Right.
So if a white person owned a slave and they decided to free them, that was called manumission.
Thanks.
Okay. So it was at the absolute discretion of the owner to manumit the slave. So she was freed by her father. Okay, along with her mother, when she just after she was born, and then she grew up as what would call a free woman of color, who then married her father, her white father's business partner, Peter Miller Watson, a Scotsman from Orkney, and Peter and Anna had this black child called Andrew Watson, and he was born in 1856. In 1859, he brought him to England. Along with his sister. And then he educated him at the top schools in England. He went to the Fowell Grammar School in Halifax, which was a feeder for Oxford and Cambridge. He went to King's College in London. He matriculated under Lord Kelvin at Glasgow University, the famous Grand Old Man of Scotland, you know, of the Kelvinator fame, the gyro compass inventor and so on. He did mathematics and philosophy with him. And everywhere he went, he played football. So this guy ended up captaining the Scottish national team in 1881, 82, and thrashed England 6-1 at the Oval, playing a kind of football that the English up until that point had not seen. English at that time, under people like Par Jackson, were playing this like just very, you know, sort of rough game where you just grab the ball and just charge to the other end of the field, try and get it in the goal and people knock you out the way. It was very rough. It was very just uncouth.
Yeah.
The Scottish, because of the clan system in the Scotland, that you're only as good as the sum of your parts, worked out that the ball could travel faster than you could. And if you passed the ball around, you could outwit the other side and get the ball in, and the whole team would. So it wasn't about the individual, it was about the team. So this was the beginning of what we now call the passing and running game. Andrew Watson, as the captain, the black captain of Scotland in 1881, comes to England, thrashes England 6-1 at the Oval with this game. A few days later, goes to Wales, thrashes Wales about 5-1. And the English then said, we need to know how to play this game. So they called him the Scotch professor, and they invited him to England to teach the English the passing and running game, which is the game of football as we know it today. This is a time before the penalty kick was introduced. This is before there was such a thing as offside or a throw-in, okay? So Andrew Watson is now this black, Scottish, you know, Guyanese, you know, son of an...
Founder of the modern game. Forget tiki-taki. I mean, this is brilliant.
Teaching the English this, the game that we play today, one of the architects of the very game itself.
Which just goes to show that history can be rewritten, because I know nothing about this. Very few of my listeners will have heard of this guy. And so, like so many people of color or from different communities, written out completely, Malik.
Well, he was. And the film that the BBC Scotland did back in 2003 that I saw, which sparked my journey, was called Scotland's Lost Captain. And it was the discovery of Andrew Watson by a guy called Jed O'Brien, who was the founder of the Scottish Football Museum, and who spent the last 20 years like just being the expert on all things to do with Andrew Watson. It was presented by the football pundit, Stuart Cosgrove, who has a football show on BBC Radio 6. So they got the football side of his story really, really absolutely spot on. But the familial side of the story was actually quite wrong. They had this guy travelling off and going and dying in India or Australia. It was very unclear. And I looked at this guy, and he looked just like me. He came from the same place in Demerara as my father came from. And my dad's name was Reginald Watson. My grandfather was George Edward Watson. Okay? So I'm sitting there thinking to myself, this guy looks like me. He comes from the same place in Demerara. You know, he's got the family name of my father. Like, I need to know, am I connected to this guy? Because I may have some history to actually be proud of, because I've been brought up on a council estate, being told to go back to where you came from, being persona non grata, being made to feel like I didn't belong anywhere.
Yeah.
Despite my father coming over and fighting the Nazis to defend the country. You know, I needed to know this history. So I started off on a family tree genealogical quest to know who my father was. And that took me back to the sugarcane plantations of Demerara. And that's where this book, Searching for My Slave Roots, becomes. Because when you get past a certain point, slavery just happens.
That's, you know? Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, because if I do my family, you know, my aunt did my family history with Glaswegian, we go all the way up and the whole thing. There are tragedies, but I know that there's not going to be enslaved people there. Now, when you do, I mean, you know, with the, how can I frame this prop? How can I say this properly? But you know that you know, your ancestors come from a place where there were slaves. And on a personal level for you, Malik, to actually go there and know that your bloodline has been enslaved. And listen, it's a lovely story that, you know, he takes the wife to Scotland, et cetera, and Andrew Watson's born. But
take the wife. Wife disappeared. All right. We never saw her again.
Right.
He brought the children.
Right, okay. But if you know, for example, Belgian Congo, horrendous things happened. And it was a rare occurrence that this would happen, because normally they would just have, you know, what, you know, girlfriends or, you know, girls at wherever they were working, and not them bringing back to Europe. So when you start researching, were you kind of prepared emotionally and mentally for what you're going to discover?
No.
Right.
No. What I discovered was both the most gruesome and harrowing history that you could possibly imagine, but it was at the same time the most epic story of empire. That, like, it's a story that just hasn't previously been told. The books have been closed on the period of slavery and colonialism because of how grotesque it was. And looking at it through today's lens, you see it for what it is. But at the time, everything was justified. Slavery was legal. It was legal for a white man to rape a black woman. It was legal. Any white man could rape any black woman without consequences on a plantation. Or it was just lawful. It was normal for a white man to arrive in the colonies and buy a black woman and just use her sexually. Okay, have children with her, and either abandon her, enslave the children, sell the children, sell the woman. He could kill them if he wanted to. He could whip them if they were insubordinate. He could do whatever he wanted to them. And the people who were making these laws in Parliament also owned the plantations. So what was the big revelations for me was not so much the black side of the family. It was when I found the white side of the family. And the white side of the family, on Peter Miller Watson's side, Andrew Watson's dad, he was working for a company called Sam Bachtini & Co., which was based in Liverpool and Glasgow, okay?
Yeah.
So in Glasgow, the partner there, Charles Stuart Parker, was building slave ships on the Clyde and shipping them out, and he was insuring enslaved cargoes through Caledonia Insurance, which became Guardian Insurance, which became AXA. He was married into the same family as Peter Miller Watson through his one of the founder's nieces. And you had this Peter Miller Watson's mother herself, who was a woman called Christian Robertson, who has a bloodline that goes back to Robert the Bruce, the Plantagenets, and King Edward I. And because these rich Scottish merchants were all either marrying the freed women of colour, which are the children of their business partners with enslaved women, or they're just raping slaves, okay? Black children are happening all over the place with white blood in them. And this sort of, I would like to say tradition, but it's not a tradition. It's just that this crime against humanity that was occurring was so prolific that you just ended up with generations and generations, like the whole entire population almost, who came from these kind of liaisons. So when you get back a couple of generations, because my father's born in 1918,
yeah.
My grandfather's in the 1880s,
yeah.
Slavery was only abolished in Brazil, which borders Guyana, in 1888. It was only abolished in 1880 in Cuba. It was only abolished in 1867 in America. Britain abolished it officially in 1833. But carried on doing it with this company, Sam Bastini. I've got them landing a cargo of Negroes on the coast of Demerara in 1847. So, you know, they were doing it illegally long after it was so-called emancipation.
Yeah.
But this family, the Sandbach family and the Tinney family, Tinney was a Dutchman who joined the company in 1814, and Sandbach was the mayor of Liverpool, who founded the Bank of Liverpool and many institutions in Liverpool, including the Royal Institution. The Royal Institution is the forerunner to the University of Liverpool and John Moores University. But he was also you know, the founder of the Botanical Gardens. He was a co-founder, along with William Roscoe, of the School for the Deaf. He was a co-founder of many philanthropic institutions, as were the Tinneys. If you know Liverpool, the city of Liverpool, the whole area of Egbeth was Samuel Sandbach's. He designed and sold off all the plots to do that. These guys owned Everton. He's buried at the Church of St. George in Everton, the cast iron church, which used to be a gated community for rich merchants high up on the hill where they could see their ships. It was only when the potato famine came that the poor Irish moved in, and then all the rich merchants moved out and decanted to Egbeth. And then, you know, Everton became very much an Irish Protestant area. So this family, when I started looking at them, they've got this royal bloodline. Christian Robertson, who's the grandmother of the black footballer Andrew Watson, her husband James Watson is the chamberlain for Lord Dundas, the Earl of Orkney.
Right.
So now you've got this kind of these connections, these powerful connections within the family, that Andrew Watson has got in his orbit. So this is why he has this really unusual sort of scenario, where as a sort of black mixed race kid, he's coming over to England and he's plugged into this network of really rich and powerful people. So in footballing terms, he ends up playing for the Corinthians. Of the Corinthian spirits. This is like the most famous club in the world. And you know, it's a gentleman's club. You have to be, you know, a gentleman to join this. These are guys who, when the penalty kick was introduced, they refused to take it. They would kick the ball in the opposite direction. If someone got a penalty against them, they'd move aside and give them an open goal. You know, they thought it was bringing the game into disrepute when they started paying salaries to players. So, you know, this, and he's playing for them.
Yeah.
So he's right at the top of his game, this guy, an incredible find historically. But when I look at his father and his father's family, all I see is two things that run right throughout the entire family. One is ecclesiastical ministers of religion, and the other is slave traders. So his mother, Christian, her uncle, George Robertson, is a slave trader. He's got plantations in Grenada. He's got plantations in Demerara. He's got shipping line. He's got all of this stuff going on, and he's prolific in dealing in enslaved people. His brother, which is Christian's father, Harry Robertson, is a minister of religion. He's the Reverend Harry Robertson, Doctor of Divinity, mm-hmm. and she's born at the manse of Kilturn. So she's being born in the church, in the house attached to the church. So he's a minister of religion, and he's receiving annuities like money every year from the slave trading concern for himself, his family, and his ministry. And his children are all receiving from the slave trader uncle. So you've got this kind of relationship between the church and the slave traders that plays out down every single line of this family.
But the thing is,
these guys are spending their money, the proceeds of slavery, in building really ornate churches. And the church people, are, you know, the reverends in these churches are absolving them from their sins for all the rape and murder and all this other stuff that they're doing, working people to death 24 hours a day on a plantation. And it's kind of a right hand washes the left hand kind of scenario within the family. And one of the most interesting things that I found about Christian Robertson, this is Andrew Watson's grandmother, who's, you know, up at the manse of Kilturn, her third cousin is Anne Mackenzie Robertson, who is the mother of Prime Minister William Ewart Gladstone.
That's a mic drop moment. But it's really interesting. We've only got 3 minutes, Mike, and it's been absolutely brilliant. But it's really interesting because you have that idea of, okay, because we're always, the narrative is always, oh, well, the UK, we had Wilberforce, slavery stopped, hurrah for us. But you look at it, and all these great philanthropists, where does the money come from? And that's what they're doing. And also giving to the church, which is, if you like, is a selling of favors. It's the, we're the great philanthropists. We're doing wonderful things, but actually the harsh reality is much, much darker. How do you sort of, didn't you want to throw your laptop at the wall at some points because you're reading this stuff?
No. It's about being sort of dispassionate about it as much as possible, to try and be as objective about what you find. I found that I am the descendant, not only of the enslaver, but of the enslaver. I'm a descendant of both. That's a very awkward history. It's an awkward thing to come to terms with, but it's just there in the history. So you've got to say it for what it is. You know, I'm a descendant of both. The same thing when you looking at the nuance of these individuals, like the abolitionist William Wilberforce. William Wilberforce, if you look in his diaries, he was best mates with John Gladstone. John Gladstone, the father of Prime Minister William Ewart Gladstone, was the biggest single recipient of slavery compensation at the end of emancipation. The slaves were supposed to be compensated by Parliament for having been enslaved. What happened was John Gladstone, the father of William Ewart Gladstone, with William Ewart Gladstone also in Parliament in a kind of junior capacity, campaigning for abolition with compensation, but not compensation for the enslaved for having been enslaved, but compensation for the enslavers for the loss of their labour when they have to free them after the Emancipation Act. And John Gladstone is the biggest, largest individual recipient of that. And you know, he is best friends with William Wilberforce. And how the money went from being for slaves to being for the slave traders, we're now starting to understand that it was Wilberforce who sold the slaves out to curry favour with John Gladstone in order to get back in his good books. And you know, and in the end, Gladstone got the majority of the money and became the hero of all the Scottish planters because he was the guy who managed to get everybody compensated for the loss of their slaves. 10 years before, in 1823, they had the Demerara uprising, which started on one of Gladstone's plantations, and people died and property was destroyed, and Gladstone was blamed. So he went from being a pariah to being a hero. And he was presented by the West India Committee with a silver salver with an inscription on it for negotiating favourable terms for the emancipation of the slaves. So, you know, and William Ewart Gladstone was promoted as an abolitionist because he advocated for abolition. But his father got out of the 20 million that was given in compensation, which was a huge amount in 1833. His father got over £100,000. The second largest recipient was this family that enslaved my ancestors, Sandbach Tinney, of which Gladstone's mother was their cousin. So they're also part of this same family network. And all of that is just 20 years of research has gone into this book. It retells the history of Gladstone. It retells a history to some degree of Wilberforce. It retells the history of enslavement as we know it, of the role of Demerara Sugar in financing the foundations of institutions of knowledge production, like, you know, like the Liverpool University, like John Moores University. And it's available now. It officially launches tomorrow, which is the 28th. Of August, and that is the actual anniversary of the 1833 Emancipation Act when it received its royal assent. So I'm going to be doing a whole series of tours across the UK. Tomorrow night I'm going to be up at...
Malik, I'm going to run out of time and crash the news. You could, listeners, order the book via our own bookstore. The book is called Searching for My Slave Roots. Malik, it's been an absolute education to speak to you today.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.